It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived once again. And joining us from our pool of statewide pool of political analysts, Donna Hoffman is with us, department head and associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Donna.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Joining Donna in the Cedar Falls studio of IPR, Scott Peters, associate professor of political science at UNI. Scott, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, plenty to talk about. A little later, we'll talk more about the travel ban, the executive order issued last Friday by President Trump. Will it keep us safer? Is it constitutional? What about that rollout with many of the insiders not aware of it until it was actually signed? Also, that new org chart for the National Security Council raising some eyebrows with the inclusion of Steve Bannon. And is the firing of acting Attorney General, Sally Yates, is she a hero, or did she betray the Department of Justice, as the administration contends? A couple of things we'll look at a little bit later in the hour, but first of all, of course, the nomination made last night by President Trump to fill that vacant ninth seat almost a year ago that it was Justice Scalia died. We'd like to get your reaction. In six words or less, tweet us at IPR Talk, six words or less, your reaction to Neil Gorsuch. Gorsuch being chosen. Let's start with that nomination, shall we, Donna and Scott? He's a 49-year-old federal appeals court judge, Neil Gorsuch, filling that long vacated seat of Antonin Scalia. Here's President Trump announcing that in the East Room of the White House last night.
Depending on their age, a justice can be active for 50 years, and his or her decisions can last a century or more, and can often be permanent. I took the task of this nomination very seriously. I have selected an individual whose qualities define, really, and I mean closely define, what we're looking for. Judge Gorsuch has outstanding legal skills, a brilliant mind, tremendous discipline, and has earned bipartisan support. When he was nominated to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, he was confirmed by the Senate unanimously. Also, that's unanimous. Can you believe that nowadays with what's going on?
Part of what President Trump had to say introducing Judge Gorsuch last night. And here's Judge Gorsuch speaking alongside the president.
I respect, too, the fact that in our legal order, it is for Congress and not the courts to write new laws. It is the role of judges to apply, not alter, the work of the people's representatives. A judge who likes every outcome he reaches is very likely a bad judge, stretching for results he prefers rather than those the law demands.
Okay. Donna Hoffman, start us off. What do you think of Donald Trump's pick in Judge Gorsuch?
Well, first of all, I'd say Trump's a little optimistic there in terms of 50-plus years for Gorsuch on the court, because he'd be 99. It is true, however, that he's one of the younger appointments, and that is something that some presidents put a high premium on so that they will serve for a long time on the court. The other thing I'd note about Trump's comments there is he mentioned that he was confirmed unanimously by the Senate, and that's a little bit there's a qualitative difference there. He was actually confirmed on a voice vote back in 2006. But certainly that typically means that he's relatively uncontroversial when they do those kinds of votes. But nevertheless, we have here, you know, somebody who's going to make Donald Trump supporters happy in terms of his conservative background. He's even to the right, most people have assessed, in terms of Scalia. And the rollout here, while there was some question about how that would be handled by the Trump administration. So, for example, we knew that Hardiman, the other pick, was also in town. It was an evening rollout, which is unusual. That there was some concern, I think, on the part of people who watch the presidency and these kinds of things in particular, that the format here might be kind of odd. But it actually was done in the East Room. The evening was a bit unusual, but the other person that he didn't pick did not appear, so it wasn't apprentice-like in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Scott Peters, tell us a little bit more. We heard Judge Gorsuch talk a little bit about his approach. How do you interpret that? And from what you've read, what is his approach to interpreting the Constitution?
Well, I mean, he's been on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals for about 10 years. He's got a record on several issues that will certainly come up again on the Supreme Court, things that the Supreme Court deals with pretty frequently. although he hasn't actually heard a lot of cases dealing with, in fact, maybe in any cases dealing with abortion itself, he actually has written a book on issues of right to life as they pertain to euthanasia and assisted suicide. And although I've not read the book, from what I understand, looking at comments online and reviews of the book, it's pretty likely that he would use those basic principles to rule that there is no right to privacy that guarantees abortion, for example. He was involved in the religious liberty cases, some of the recent religious liberty cases that came to the court, ultimately including the Hobby Lobby case involving contraception under Obamacare. And one issue that's getting a lot of attention among those who pay close attention to the courts is his belief that courts should pay less deference to executive branch's interpretation of laws. And that's something that you can get pretty technical pretty quickly on. But
what does that mean?
Well, so when the court is reviewing bureaucratic regulations to see if they're consistent with the law that Congress has passed, there's something called the Chevron Doctrine, a case handed down back in the 1980s, in which the Supreme Court basically said that the judges should defer to the executive branch's interpretation of the statute as much as possible. And he really seems to question that and argue that that is a formula for sort of runaway executive branch control, and that one of the jobs of the courts should be to be more assertive at reining in the executive branch in that sense. Mm-hmm. So if that were to, you know, if that view were to gain traction on the court, it could spell quite a change in terms of how the judicial branch interprets its role in terms of legislative-executive relationship.
Talk about whether the Democrats plan to put up a fight. They do. To what degree? Talk about it in just a minute. But talk to this point a little bit, Donna Hoffman, in looking at past judicial nominees. Once they're appointed, they can sometimes surprise the presidents who appointed them and not be exactly the justice that they were outlined to be when they were put on the court.
That's true. We have some famous examples of that. But generally speaking, most of the justices you've had lately, maybe David Souter is the exception here, have generally fell into what people thought they would the role mm-hmm. that they would fall into. So there certainly is room for people to grow. There certainly are dynamics on the Supreme Court that can generally not necessarily alter their belief system, but can shape the way that they look at constitutional doctrines and especially precedent. And so it's always an open question when a president picks someone here as to how will they really turn out. And there are occasionally, case-by-case surprises, and sometimes there's even surprises in terms of a particular individual not quite turning out the way the president thought that they would.
Mm-hmm. Asking our listeners your reaction, six words or less, your reaction to the president's nomination of Neil Gorsuch to fill the long-vacated seat of Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. Six words or less. These are about six words. Logan on Twitter writes, turnabout is fair play. Never confirm no to any GOP nominee ever. Angela in Des Moines on Twitter, theft in progress, thieves likely successful. Of course, this is the Democrats' thing that the seat has been stolen based on, it was almost a year ago that Antonin Scalia died, and the Republicans in the Senate, headed by also Charles Grassley as the head of the Judiciary Committee, successfully blocked even having any hearings, let alone a vote on Justice Garland. Now the Senate's top Democrat, Chuck Schumer, indicated his party, the Democrats, would mount a procedural hurdle requiring 60 votes in the 100-seat Senate rather than a simple majority to approve Gorsuch. Let's listen to Delaware Senator Chris Coons. He's a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. This morning on NPR's Morning Edition, he was asked whether he and other Democrats plan to filibuster the Gorsuch nomination. He began by clarifying filibuster.
Well, let's first be clear about what a filibuster means here. The two justices that were confirmed under President Obama's term both had to clear a 60-vote bar. Both Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor were confirmed by a greater than 60-vote margin. And Senator Schumer has already said he will insist on a 60-vote margin for this vote. That is technically, quote-unquote, a filibuster. But I find in talking to folks at home in Delaware that they have a image in their head, perhaps from movies, that a filibuster means putting on a diaper, staying up all night, and talking for 12 hours. What I'm focused on is the first step, which is ensuring that Judge Gorsuch gets the full and thorough hearing and vetting in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee that D.C. Circuit Judge Merrick Garland, nominated by President Obama for this vacancy nearly a year ago, never received. I think the American people deserve to hear what Judge Gorsuch's answers are to probing and tough and challenging questions about his views on a wide range of constitutional issues.
Delaware Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat. So should Democrats block confirmation any way they can or try to? Or should Republicans go nuclear? That phrase pertaining to a rules change that would lower the bar to 50 rather than 60 votes to confirm the high court nominee. Do you get a sense of what's going on, how the Democrats have decided, Donna?
No, I don't. And I think they themselves haven't decided quite yet as well. Because there's obviously, and in the base, and you know, a couple of the things that you read from listeners that who had sent their six words in, gets at this. The base is mad. The Democratic base. The base is mad about the way that Merrick Garland was treated. They want revenge. They want this to be stalled. They want it to stop. But at the same time, Democrats who are in the Senate have some different calculations here. So the question becomes, first of all, if you're a Democratic senator in a red state, of which there's a handful of them coming up for re-election in 2018, you got to think about that. You also have to think about down the road. I mean, will Trump get more Supreme Court nominations? If we filibuster, will McConnell, quote-unquote, go nuclear, meaning change the rules here to disallow filibusters on these particular kinds of nominees, which the Democrats did back in 2013 for Obama's lower court nominees and his executive branch nominees. But the Republicans started this back in, 2005. So we have this continual tit for tat here. At the end of the day, the Democrats have to wrestle with all of these things and decide how to go forward. And at the end of the day, we need nine people on the Supreme Court. Now, Democrats have to, decide on the Senate what they're going to do here. And there's a lot of strategy and tactics and calculation that they have to do. And, personally, somebody's going to have to be a grown-up at the end of the day. However, having said that, the Democratic base is really mad. And you have parallels here, potentially with the Tea Party movement that we've seen recently. And so the Democrats are still wrestling with this kind of thing. Chuck Schumer is getting people camping out on his doorstep right now because he's not being sufficiently strong on some of the cabinet appointments, some of the people, some of his constituents think. And so public opinion matters here, and certainly the base public opinion for Democrats matters here as well. And I still don't think that they've decided exactly what their course is going to be. And also, we ought to let this particular individual have a hearing. But again, that gets into how Merrick Garland was treated and that they're really upset about that. And in a hearing, as Coons was talking about in the clip that you played, things can come out. We can allay fears. Maybe fears are ramped up. It just kind of depends on how that interaction goes forward.
Mm-hmm. Tim is joining us in Mason City. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. I think, Tim, your comments are along the lines of what Donna just mentioned. We don't know quite what Judge Gorsuch is all about. Are you willing to find out more?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I have a lot of respect for him, as much as I've learned about him. Excuse me. But my question is for your guests there. Judge Gorsuch, some have said that he was appointed because he was a clerk to Justice Kennedy and may be able to influence Kennedy, which I think is an insult to Kennedy. Kennedy, I'm sure, listens to everyone and takes everything into consideration. So what do your guests think about that notion that Gorsuch may be an influence on Kennedy?
Okay, with his connection to Kennedy known as a swing vote on the court for a long time. Scott Peters, what do you have to say to that?
Yeah, he was a clerk to Justice Kennedy, and I've seen those same things. I've seen a lot of people have observed that since Justice Kagan joined the court, that she has had some sort of sway on Justice Kennedy and is pulling him farther to the left, and that this was a strategic move for two purposes. One, to sort of pull Justice Kennedy back to the right, and supposedly to send some sort of signal to Justice Kennedy that Donald Trump is reasonable and will nominate mainstream conservatives to make it easier then for Kennedy to retire during Trump's presidency. I guess my reaction to that is, first of all, I was kind of surprised by the open speculation of that. I mean, presumably Kennedy reads the papers, and so to the extent that one then telegraphs that strategy, it seems like that sort of defeats the whole purpose. Secondly, Justice Kennedy has always struck me as someone who is very, very cognizant and aware of his own legacy and his own, sort of what his epitaph is going to be when he leaves the court. And I think that thinking that that he's sort of going to allow himself to get pulled in one direction or another, I don't know, that just strikes me as wishful thinking on the part of conservatives.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what may come after this. This is the first step, a replacement, if you will, for Judge Scalia, perhaps more or less on par with Scalia, perhaps a little bit more conservative. I think you mentioned that, Donna, early on. But the three oldest members of the court, Kennedy, we just mentioned, 80 years old, also some senior members of the liberal part of the court, Ginsburg, Breyer, 83 years old, and 78 years old. So another appointment to Donna is entirely possible, and with another one by Trump, that would mean what? A solid five-justice conservative majority.
Well, if it were one of the people on that side of the court to go. But, we didn't expect Justice Scalia to die a year ago either. So lots of things can happen here. One of the reasons why, this particular nomination is probably going to be different than one to come if a liberal member were to leave the court is that this doesn't change the dynamic of the court because Scalia was on the right side. Gorsuch is going to be on the right side. It's when you would have someone being nominated to replace somebody who's ideologically very different, which is what we saw with, why the Republicans really went to the mat in terms of blocking Merrick Garland, because should Obama have gotten that appointment, it would have changed that dynamic of the court. And they were successful in doing that, which is, a whole nother, we could have a whole show on the norms involved in that. But nevertheless, that's something that we look going forward if one of those liberal justices were to leave the court, and then there would be still a President Trump to appoint their successor that would change the dynamics. Then you have all kinds of interesting things happening in the Senate, which is one of the reasons why the Senate Democrats, this is one of the calculations, may want to, kind of go easy. Go easy not in the sense of not be hard on him, but be very measured, I should say, in terms of how they approach this, because they may not want to push McConnell to get rid of the filibuster. I don't know that McConnell personally wants to do it, but Trump is certainly already on record as saying that McConnell should. But preserve that to the extent that they can in this particular confirmation fight, because they may want it and maybe want to highlight then if it's blown up in a subsequent appointment.
Donna Hoffman with us of the University of Northern Iowa, as well as Scott Peters, our political scientist on this politics edition of River to River. Coming up on a break, but let's squeeze in a caller here. Danielle calling from Woodward. What's on your mind as we discuss President Trump's nominee to the high court?
Well, I'd like to ask both of your guest professors in terms of arguing that an originalist is what Trump wants on the court. I'm thinking of the District of Columbia versus Heller, and Scalia, the alleged originalist, actually went beyond the original interpretation mm-hmm. for the Second Amendment, which said a well-equipped or well-regulated militia. And today we have six-hour handguns that have magazines in it. So my argument is judges in the mold of Scalia go beyond being an originalist. They are making very politically ideological choices, and I think it's very dangerous.
Okay, Danielle, thank you. Scott, talk about that. We put these labels like originalist on their approaches to the high court. How much do these labels mean? What does originalist mean?
Well, that's a great question. As a political scientist, what I can tell you is that judges take these things seriously, and people who watch the courts take these things seriously. And so there are certainly, there are judges who ascribe to particular judicial philosophies, for example. I can also tell you, though, that those judicial philosophies tend to correlate pretty closely with particular ideological patterns, you know. So people who ascribe to originalist philosophies much more often than not end up with conservative outcomes. Now, that doesn't mean that you can predict every single individual case perfectly, but it does mean that you can make pretty darn good guesses based on some of those basic philosophies that people espouse. In a lot of ways, Judge Gorsuch is a very typical Republican appointee. I mean, he is somebody who any Republican president might have appointed to this vacancy. Of course, what's unique here is that this is not a unique vacancy, right? Or rather, this is not a typical vacancy. As Donna's already explained, the political stakes are much different than normal because it's a vacancy that's been held open for a year. And it's obviously, with the context of the presidential election, a much different vacancy than we've seen before.
Okay. Before we go to break, Donna, talk about the Merrick Garland hold up the block on him. Does that set a precedent? Could that be moved even further ahead? I mean, we had the last year of Obama's presidency evidently not deemed to be long enough to have him nominate a candidate, an appointee to the court, according to the Senate's GOP leaders. Could that be moved up even further? Where does that stop?
It could, and that's the best question, you know, of the day. Where does that stop? And you know, could Democrats, you know, string this out for an indefinite time period? Unlikely. But it does set a dangerous precedent in terms of just sheer governance. We need a court with a full complement of justices on it. And that 1 year, you know, holding that open in the last year of a president's term is very, very dangerous. And the argument that many of the Republicans made was that the people should decide. Well, the people don't decide. The Constitution doesn't say the people decide.
Right, but you could say Clinton won the popular vote, so the people did decide, but they didn't decide.
And that's another wrinkle that you can bring into that as well.
Okay, we've got to come back after a short break. Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, along with her colleague Scott Peters in the Political Science Department. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about the travel ban, so-called travel ban. Has it affected you or your family? Join us, 1-866-780-9100. Politics Day. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Politics Wednesday, with Scott Peters and Donna Hoffman, political scientists at the University of Northern Iowa, joining us today in our Iowa City studio. We hope you'll join us as well. The first half mostly dedicated to that Supreme Court nominee that our president, Donald Trump, put forward. In the later part of the show, we're going to talk about the immigration order. So many political things happening so quickly on our landscape. We have to give short shrift to some of them. We hope to talk about the Security Council yet this half hour. Also, as I said, the immigration executive order and the firing of Sally Gates, the acting attorney general for the United States. But first of all, a week after President Trump's inauguration, 6 days after that Women's March, remember the hats, crowds of people again gathered in Washington, D.C. last weekend for the March for Life. That was last Friday, I guess. Last week on this program, we spoke with an Iowan who attended that Women's March this week, an attendee of the March for Life last Friday. Nathan Beacom is with us, a Des Moines Register. You were in Washington last Friday, Nathan?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Why did you feel it was important to make the trip?
Well, because I'm someone who I studied philosophy in college, and my research focus was on ethics and the philosophy of science. And I became convinced through those studies that the fetus or the unborn baby in utero is the very same organism, the very same valuable, unique human life as when that baby exits the uterus and we begin to call it a baby. And I think if that's the case, you know, we owe to that human life the same sort of protection that we afford all human life.
Mm-hmm. What do you say? What do you say to women who say, "I want to make choices about my body, not to have the government do it"?
Right. In this case, if it is, as I think there are good reasons to think so, an unborn human being, if there are two human beings in the equation, we have to consider the value of both human beings. And that doesn't mean that the infant takes precedence over the mother or the mother takes precedence over the infant. We have a duty, I think, a sort of obligation to care for both the mother and the child. And that's something that continues. It doesn't just end when the child is born, but is a sort of demand of social justice on us to care for both throughout the whole course of their life.
Mm-hmm. We're running short of time, Nathan. Tell us about the mood you experienced in Washington, D.C. during that march. The Vice President, Mike Pence, was in attendance.
Yeah, I would say the mood was largely positive and optimistic. It was a very diverse crowd, skewed young and female. There was a lot of energy, a lot of hope for where things are going in the future.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel, with the announcement last night by Donald Trump, that the Supreme Court is the way? This march actually is pegged to the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That's right. I'm no judicial expert, but I do think this is given even to a lot of pro-life people like myself who are not supporters of Donald Trump. This is a judge that seems to have a solid jurisprudence, and I think people have high hopes.
Okay, Nathan Beacom, thank you for joining us. Des Moines resident who demonstrated in Washington, D.C.'s March for Life last Friday. That on the heels of talking with a women's march attendee last week on this program. Before we move on to the immigration orders, Scott, Donna, can you tell us if this court, if the nominee is approved, isn't it way too early to tell which of the issues, be it abortion or gun rights and so forth, will be overturned or challenged, environmental regulations? Or do we have any hints here, Scott?
Well, as it pertains to abortion in particular, this nomination won't change anything on the court. It'll be a status quo situation. Just last year in that big case out of Texas, the Supreme Court once again reaffirmed the basic right to abortion and struck down a series of state regulations limiting access to abortion. And that was with a 5-justice majority. So that won't change at all. But yeah, certainly on other issues, it might be somewhat premature, and there are issues he's never had to deal with as a judge. And like I said earlier, you know, we can say pretty confidently that his overall trend in decisions is going to be outcomes that decisions that favor conservative outcomes. On any given issue, justices surprise us from time to time.
Mm-hmm. And yesterday, I'll just throw this in, Donald Trump vowing yesterday to uphold protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people working for federal contractors. The White House said yesterday Trump would continue to enforce the executive orders signed in 2014 by Barack Obama. Is that a surprise at all, Donna Hoffman?
Well, I would say not necessarily, in terms of the Trump administration up to this point has been, unpredictable in that sense. But it certainly is something that at least some of his supporters were hoping that he might write another EO to overturn that, and he's going to keep that in place.
Okay, let's talk about this immigration order that's been causing so much concern, chaos, the rollout and so forth. Trump signing an executive order last Friday temporarily halting travel to the U.S. by residents of 7 majority Muslim countries, also suspending refugee admissions for 120 days, indefinitely shutting down the admission of Syrian refugees to this country. Another provision in the order giving Christians and other religious minorities in these largely Muslim countries priority to immigrate to the United States. President Trump says it's necessary, have to protect the U.S. from terrorism, and these are the steps to do to take it. I'm looking at a poll put out yesterday by Reuters, Ipsos, an opinion poll. Less than one-third of Americans believe the move makes them, quote, more safe. Let's talk about aspects of this. Here is some of the chaos, the confusion. This is a little sound from a protest at Los Angeles International Airport. Donna Hoffman, the way in which this was rolled out, I understand many top administration officials not asked to review the order before it was given. Passengers barred from flights to the United States. Customs and Border Control officials got instructions in the wee hours of the morning. They came to their work in the morning not knowing how to carry out the president's orders.
Right. There was a lot of chaos associated with that. There were differing things coming out of various people about how permanent residents or green card holders were going to be treated with that particular order. But the rollout was of it and the crafting of it was particularly interesting here because executive orders have a certain form. They have certain legalese that needs to be in there. Donald Trump, so far, his executive orders and looking at them do have some kind of interesting language in them related especially to campaign rhetoric, I would say. And this was one of them that did that. But one of the things that is really troubling about this, there has been a lot of commentary about some congressional staffers working on this in the House Judiciary Committee. And
without the knowledge of their superiors.
Right. And it's not unusual for an executive, the executive branch and the legislative branch to coordinate on policy matters. What's really unusual here and really, quite frankly, troubling is that these staffers apparently were doing so under nondisclosure agreements. That their bosses, in this case, this was Representative Goodlatte, wasn't aware of this, even though he was aware some people were working for had worked for the transition. The congressional leadership wasn't informed here. And then, as you mentioned, you had significant secretaries, especially in incoming in state, defense, Department of Homeland Security, they're going to be charged with implementing this that didn't know about it or had a very late heads up about it. Here's one of the things you need to know, and this is why you know the lack of experience of the Trump administration is problematic, is that you're not the sole actor here. You have to rely on Congress to fund your executive orders if there's something in there that costs money because you don't have any funds. You have to rely on the other people in your executive branch to execute those orders, and if there's uncertainty or if they haven't been given proper deference, these are people who are governing the agencies that are going to carry these out. It can poison the well. It can cause for really bad relations. To do this that many, a week in, essentially, is quite problematic and also then had the effect of not exactly knowing what to do in terms of the implementation here.
Right, and Scott speaks to this, not only his own administration, major leaders in his administration, but also the GOP Congress caught off guard here as well.
Yes, they were caught off guard, and I would add that the order also does not appear to have been properly vetted through legal channels, through lawyers, and that is going to continue to cause the administration problems. We saw pretty much immediately, within 24 hours of the order, we saw that parts of it had been stayed by U.S. district courts, I think we're going to continue to see legal challenges. There are several parts of it that are potentially problematic. There's a 1965 law that forbids discriminating in terms of immigration, forbids discriminating based on nationality.
What about the discrimination that's apparent favoring Christians over other over Muslims in immigration? That's what you're referring to.
That's actually not what I'm referring to. There's a separate law. Our immigration laws used to be racist. They used to have quota systems. You basically couldn't immigrate to the country if you were from Africa, et cetera. In 1965, we changed that and we said we're going to have certain standards to determine if you immigrate, but where you're coming from isn't one of them. As it pertains to immigration in particular, not just the issuance of run-of-the-mill visas, but immigration, that part of the order could very well be illegal under that 1965 statute. The religious test could also be illegal. There's certainly question over how much those protections apply to foreign aliens living abroad. But it's quite possible that effectively requiring a religious test could violate the Establishment Clause of the Constitution.
Our Governor Terry Branstad reacting to the travel ban from last Friday in his weekly news conference on Monday, saying he supports the ban, but he's not going to second guess how the policy is being implemented.
This should not have been a surprise to anybody. The president campaigned on taking action to prevent of people from coming from countries that don't have stable governments where there's significant Islamic radical extremist activity.
Okay, Governor Branstad there on Monday. So we talked about the rollout, the constitutionality of it a bit. Let's talk about whether it's a good strategy. Now, Governor Branstad there, you know, saying, referring to the fact we want to keep Americans safe. How do we keep America safe, I guess is the core question, battle the extremism at home and abroad, and do it in a way that doesn't alienate Muslims and foster even more radicalism? Donna, how does this measure when put up to that yardstick?
Well, I mean, that's the big question. Does it actually keep Americans safe? Because this can be a recruiting tool for terrorist entities overseas to show that, indeed, their rhetoric about America being at war with Islam is, in fact, the truth. This is something that we know that they have been spouting that can be, you know, this is evidence that can uphold that in their view of it. And so the question becomes, what's the effect of this? The intent, you know, on the surface is to, you know, for Trump to carry out a campaign promise, as Governor Branstad was referring to, essentially, to try to keep Americans safe. But is that really the effect of this particular executive order? And I think there's some open question to that.
Mm-hmm. How do you think this will play out in the weeks and months to come, Scott, Donna? Scott, you first.
Well,
we've already seen here in Iowa, all
right.
Other states, one effect is mobilizing anti-Trump sentiment even more.
Indeed. I mean, we're going to continue to see legal challenges to different aspects of it, and we'll see how those things play out. You know, the order, one thing that's overlooked is that the order gives broad authority to, I believe it's the Secretary of Homeland Security, to make recommendations to the president about how it could be broadened or whether it should be expanded to other countries. You know, I wouldn't rule out that that could happen. You know, what kind of procedures are they going to develop during these 90 to 120 days? This could end up being just temporary, and they put in place new procedures, and then they go back to them. It's really hard to say at this point. The one thing I would say about the political ramifications is that while we did see, 8 to 10 Republican senators and a handful of Republican House members speak out against some aspect of this order, as far as I can tell so far, looking at public opinion data, President Trump is still quite popular in most Republican House districts around the country, and I suspect that this order was quite popular in most Republican House districts around the country. And so until Republican voters start to lose faith or in some way question President Trump's actions, Republican politicians aren't going to have any incentive to defect from him.
Scott Peters and Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. We have less than 10 minutes left. A couple things to get your views on. Eyebrows immediately raised when Donald Trump signed a memo last Friday outlining his structure for the National Security Council. Among the biggest changes, Trump decided to make his chief strategist and former Breitbart executive, Steve Bannon, a regular attendee of the Principals Committee. The memo Trump signed also limits the attendance of the Director of National Intelligence and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in this Principals Committee. This is Arizona Senator John McCain criticizing Trump's new hierarchy there on CBS's News Face the Nation on Sunday. He criticized the decision to put White House strategist Steve Bannon on the NSC, saying it minimizes the role of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
I think the national security team around President Trump is very impressive, and I think you couldn't ask for a better one, whether it be General Kelly, General Flynn is great, General Mattis, and the ones they're bringing on board on their team. I am worried about the National Security Council. Who are the members of it, and who are the permanent members? The appointment of Mr. Bannon is something which is a radical departure from any National Security Council in history.
Okay, radical departure. Donna Hoffman, talk about Steve Bannon. Remind us who he is and why someone like John McCain would be so concerned with him being put as a permanent part of that inner circle of the National Security Council.
Well, Bannon is the chief political strategist, and typically on the NSC, we don't have political operatives being there. They may be there briefly, but they're not permanent members of that. And the reason is this. There has been a general belief that American foreign policy should not be made with the view towards the political ramifications of that of it, but what is in the overall interest of the country or the national security interest. And so by having someone who is well known as being the political mastermind behind Trump changes the dynamics of that in a couple of ways, because the political then may be considered in that forum. Another thing, though, is that Bannon will be there, and the president typically is not at these meetings. The things that are said there, Bannon is a direct conduit back to the president, and he is known for being very loyal. And so the other principal actors may not be willing to say some of the things they would say otherwise. And so there's two things there that really are quite troubling with this in terms of the way we have traditionally conducted foreign policy through the National Security Council and the advice that the president gets through the National Security Council in the post-World War II era.
Okay. Do you share that view, Scott? Anything to add?
I do. No, I don't have anything to add. I think she covered that pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Monday's firing by Donald Trump of the acting U.S. Attorney General, Sally Yates. Remember, we're waiting for confirmation of Jeff Sessions to be the new Attorney General. He was advanced in Congress just today. I think we heard that at the top of the hour. Well, this is after Sally Yates defied the White House and refused to defend these new travel restrictions targeting the seven Muslim-majority nations. Yates said late on Monday that the Justice Department would not defend the order against court challenges, saying she did not believe it would be, in her words, consistent with this institution's solemn obligation to always seek justice and stand for what is right. Hours after issuing that, she was fired by Donald Trump. The White House said Yates has betrayed the Department of Justice by refusing to enforce a legal order designed to protect the citizens of the U.S. and portrayed her actions as political. So let's get your views here before we close the hour. A hero, or did she betray the Department of Justice? Donna Hoffman.
Well, the Attorney General is the top law enforcement officer. They're to look at rule of law. They're to look at constitutional principles and apply that. They're not the president's lawyer in that sense. And we also have to parse what she said here. She said the department wouldn't defend that in terms of legal challenges. That's not the same thing as enforcement. And the primary enforcement mechanisms here are Department of Homeland Security and Department of State in particular. And so that needs to be put into proper perspective. Now, interesting, up on the Washington Post website yesterday was a little video clip of Sally Yates' confirmation hearing back in, I believe it was 2005, when she was up for deputy assistant or associate director, or attorney general, excuse me, in which Jeff Sessions in the Judiciary Committee was questioning her about her ability to say no to the president.
Mm-hmm.
And he very obviously put great stock in the ability of the person who held high positions in the Justice Department to say no to the president if the president's actions were contravening law or contravening the Constitution. And so there's a real big irony here, I see, in that Jeff Sessions was also asked these questions before the committee as well. And, you know, I was talking about this incident in class yesterday, and we were talking about precedents, unprecedented things happening. And somebody said, oh, this is unprecedented. I said, no, it's not unprecedented. But you have to understand the last time this precedent was done was called the Saturday Night Massacre, and it was in the midst of Watergate. And so it's an interesting way to start off the first couple of weeks of your administration. By doing this, it's obviously something, you know, here's a person who's a political appointee, an Obama appointee, holding over. We know Jeff Sessions is going to be in there in a few days. But Trump can also send a message to other people within his cabinet that he's not going to hesitate to fire you if you disagree with him. And that is the right of the president, because these people do serve at the pleasure of the president. But they also have some level of independence, especially when we're talking about the Department of Justice.
Okay. 30 seconds for you, Scott Peters, to round off the hour with this topic.
Sure. I would just add that that video clip that Donna mentioned where then-Senator Sessions was asking her that question, that was specifically about immigration orders. It was about President Obama's immigration orders, which Senator Sessions believed abused executive power. And so now we have basically that scenario playing out. It's just a different president making an immigration order that she believed abused executive power. We do expect, particularly in the Justice Department, we expect our high-level officials in the Justice Department to have some independence from the president.
Scott Peters, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, thank you so much for joining us. Donna is Department Head, Associate Professor of Political Science. Scott Peters, Associate Professor of Political Science. Thank the two of you for coming into the studio today and sharing your insights. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Chelsea Hoy. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Help from Tony Daner up in Cedar Falls. Thanks, Tony. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.